October 15th. He had called them collect from Julesburg. The body had been found in a dry stream bed. Police theorized that Pomeroy might actually have been killed near Highway 9 and washed into the wildlife preserve during the spring runoff. The coroner's report said the wounds had been inflicted with an axe. Paul wondered, not quite idly, how far Grider Wildlife Preserve was from here. He turned the page and looked at the last clipping, at least so far, and suddenly his breath was gone. It was as if, after wading grimly through the almost unbearable necrology in the foregoing pages, he had come face to face with his own obituary. It wasn't quite, but close enough for government work, he said in a low, hoarse voice. It was from Newsweek, the transitions column, listed below the divorce of a TV actress and above the death of a Midwestern steel potentate, was this item. Reported missing. Paul Sheldon, 42. Novelist best known for a series of romances about sexy, bubble-headed, unsinkable Misery Chastain, by his agent, Bryce Bell. I think he's fine, Bell said, but I wish he'd get in touch and ease my mind. And his ex-wives wish he'd get in touch and ease their bank accounts. Sheldon was last seen 7 weeks ago in Boulder, Colorado, where he had gone to finish a new novel. The clipping was 2 weeks old. Reported missing, that's all. Just reported missing. I'm not dead. It's not like being dead. But it was like being dead. And suddenly he needed his medication, because it wasn't just his legs that hurt. Everything hurt. He put the book carefully back in its place and began rolling the wheelchair toward the guest room. Outside, the wind gusted more strongly than it had yet done, slapping cold rain against the house, and Paul shrank away from it, moaning and afraid, trying desperately hard to hold himself together and not burst into tears. An hour later, full of dope and drifting off to sleep, the sound of the howling wind now soothing rather than frightening, he thought. I'm not going to escape. No way. What is it Thomas Hardy says in Jew the Obscure? Someone could have come along and eased the boy's terror, but nobody did. Because nobody does. Right. Correct. The ship is not going to come in because there are no boats for nobody. The Lone Ranger is busy making breakfast cereal commercials, and Superman's making movies in Tinseltown. You're on your own, Polly. Dead flat on your own. But maybe that's okay. Because maybe you know what the answer is after all, don't you? Yes, of course he did. If he meant to get out of this, he would have to kill her. Yes, that's the answer. The only one there is, I think. So it's that same old game again, isn't it, Polly? Can you? He answered with no hesitation at all. Yes, I can. His eyes drifted closed. He slept. The storm continued through the next day. The following night, the clouds unraveled and blew away. At the same time, the temperature plummeted from 60 degrees down to 25. All the world outside froze solid. Sitting by the bedroom window and looking out at the ice-glittery morning world on that second full day alone, Paul could hear Misery the pig squealing in the barn and one of the cows bellowing. He often heard the animals. They were as much a part of the general background as the chiming parlor clock. But he had never heard the pig squeal so. He thought he had heard the cow bellow like that once before. But it had been an evil sound, dimly heard in an evil dream, because then he had been full of his own pain. It had been when Annie had gone away that first time, leaving him with no pills. He had been raised in suburban Boston and had lived most of his life in New York City, but he thought he knew what those pain cow bellows meant. One of the cows needed to be milked. The other apparently didn't, possibly because Annie's erratic milking habits had already dried her up. And the pig? Hungry, that was all. And that was enough. They weren't going to get any relief today. He doubted if Annie would be able to make it back, even if she wanted to. This part of the world had turned into one big skating rink. He was a little surprised at the depth of sympathy he felt for the animals, and the depth of his anger at Annie, for how she had, in her unadmitting and arrogant egoism, left them to suffer in their pens. If your animals could talk, Annie, they would tell you who the real dirty birdie around here is. He himself was quite comfortable as those days passed. He ate from cans, drank water from the new pitcher, took his medication regularly, napped each afternoon. The tale of misery and her amnesia, and her previously unsuspected and spectacularly rotten blood kin, marched steadily along toward Africa, which was to be the setting of the novel's second half. The irony was that the woman had coerced him into writing what was easily the best of the misery novels. Ian and Jeffrey were off in Southampton outfitting a schooner called the Lorelei for the run. It was on the dark continent that Misery, who kept slipping into cataleptic trances at the most inconvenient moments, and of course if she were to be stung by another bee, ever in her entire life, she would die almost instantly, would either be killed or cured. For 150 miles inland from Lawestown, a tiny British-Dutch settlement on the northernmost tip of the Barbary Coast Dangerous Crescent, lived the Burkas, Africa's most dangerous natives. The Burkas were sometimes known as the Bee People. Few of the whites who dared to venture into Burka country had ever returned, but those who did had brought back fabulous tales of a woman's face jutting from the side of a tall, crumbling mesa, a merciless face with a gaping mouth and a huge red ruby set in her stone forehead. There was another story, only a rumor, surely, but strangely persistent, that within the caves which honeycombed the stone behind the idol's jeweled forehead, there lived a hive of giant albino bees, swarming protectively around their queen, a jelly-like monstrosity of infinite poison and infinite magic. During the days he diverted himself with this pleasant foolishness. In the evenings he sat quietly, listening to the pig squeal, and thinking about how he would kill the dragon lady. Playing Can You in real life was quite different from playing it in a cross-legged circle as a kid, or doing it in front of a typewriter as a grown-up, he discovered. When it was just a game, and even if they gave you money for it, a game was still all it was, you could think up some pretty wild things and make them seem believable. The connection between Misery Chastain and Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde, for instance. They had turned out to be half-sisters. Misery would later discover her father down there in Africa, hanging out with the Burka Bee people. In real life, however, the arcane had a way of losing its power. Not that Paul didn't try. There were all those drugs in the downstairs bathroom. Surely there was some way he could use them to put her out of the way, wasn't there? Or to at least render her helpless long enough so he could do it. Take the Novril. Enough of that shit and he wouldn't even have to put her out of the way. She would float off on her own. That's a very good idea, Paul. I tell you what to do. You just get a whole bunch of those capsules and stick them all through a pint of her ice cream. She'll just think they're pistachio nuts and gobble them right down. No, of course, that wouldn't work. Nor could he pull a cutie like opening the capsules and mixing the powder into some pre-softened ice cream. Novril in the raw was fabulously bitter. He had tasted it and knew. It was a taste you would recognize at once, in the midst of the expected sweetness. And then woe is you, Polly. Woe to the max. In a story, it would have been a pretty good idea. In real life, however, it simply did not make it. He wasn't sure he would have taken the chance, even if the white powder inside the capsules had been almost or completely tasteless. It wasn't safe enough. It wasn't sure enough. This was no game. It was his life. Other ideas passed through his mind and were rejected even more quickly. One was suspending something. The typewriter came immediately to mind. Over the door so she would be killed or knocked unconscious when she came in. Another was running a tripwire across the stairway. But the problem in both cases was the same as the old Novril in the ice cream trick. Neither was sure enough. He found himself literally unable to think of what might happen to him if he tried to assassinate her and failed. As dark came down on that second night, Misery's squealing went on as monotonously as ever. The pig sounded like an unlatched door with rusty hinges squealing in the wind. But Bossy number one abruptly fell silent. Paul wondered uneasily if perhaps the poor animal's udder had burst, resulting in death by exsanguination. For a moment, his imagination, so vivid, tried to present him with a picture of the cow lying dead in a puddle of mixed milk and blood, and he quickly willed it away. He told himself not to be such a numbnuts. Cows didn't die that way. But the voice doing the telling lacked conviction. He had no idea if they did or not. And besides, it wasn't the cow that was his problem, was it? All your fancy ideas come down to one thing. You want to kill her by remote control. You don't want her blood on your hands. You're like a man who loves nothing better than a thick steak, but wouldn't last an hour in a slaughterhouse. But listen, Polly, and get it straight. You must face reality at this point in your life, if at no other. Nothing fancy. No curlicues, right? Right. He rolled back into the kitchen and opened drawers until he found the knives. He selected the longest butcher knife and went back to his room, pausing to rub away the hub marks on the sides of the doorway. The signs of his passage were nevertheless becoming clearer. Doesn't matter. If she misses them one more time, she misses them for good. He put the knife on the night table, hoisted himself into bed, then slid it under the mattress. When Annie came back, he was going to ask her for a nice cold glass of water, and when she leaned over to give it to him, he was going to plunge the knife into her throat. Nothing fancy. Paul closed his eyes and dropped off to sleep. And when the Cherokee came whispering back into the driveway that morning at 4 o'clock, with both its engine and its lights shut off, he did not stir. Until he felt the sting of the hypo sliding into his arm, and woke to see her face leaning over his, he hadn't the slightest idea she was back. At first he thought he was dreaming about his own book, that the dark was the dream dark of the caves behind the huge stone head of the Burka bee goddess, and the sting was that of a bee. Paul. He muttered something that meant nothing. Something that meant only get out of here. Dream voice. Get gone. Paul. That was no dream voice. It was Annie's voice. He forced his eyes open. Yes, it was her. And for a moment his panic grew even stronger. Then it simply seeped away, like fluid running down a partly clogged drain. What the hell? He was totally disoriented. She was standing there in the shadows as if she had never been away, wearing one of her woolly skirts and frumpy sweaters. He saw the needle in her hand and understood it hadn't been a sting, but an injection. What the fuck? Either way, it was the same thing. He had been gotten by the goddess. But what had she... That bright panic tried to come again, and once again it hit a dead circuit. All he could feel was a kind of academic surprise. That and some intellectual curiosity about where she had come from, and why now. He tried to lift his hands and they came up a little, but only a little. It felt as if there were invisible weights dangling from them. They dropped back onto the sheet with little dull thumps. Doesn't matter what you shut me up with. It's like what you write on the last page of the book. It's the end. The thought brought no fear. Instead, he felt a kind of calm euphoria. At least she's tried to make it kind. To make it...
Ah, there you are,
Annie said, and added with lumbering coquettishness,
I see you, Paul. Those blue eyes. Did I ever tell you what lovely blue eyes you have? But I suppose other women have. Women who were much prettier than I am, and much bolder about their affections as well.
Came back. Came creeping in the night and killed me. Hypo or bee sting, no difference. And so much for the knife under the bed. All I am now is the latest number in Annie's considerable body count. And then, as the numbing euphoria of the injection began to spread, he thought almost with humor, some lousy Scheherazade I turned out to be. He thought that in a moment sleep would return, a more final sleep, but it did not. He saw her slip the hypo into the pocket of her skirt, and then she sat down on the bed. Not where she usually sat, however. She sat on its foot, and for a moment he saw only her solid, impervious back as she bent over, as if to check on something. He heard a wooden thunk, a metallic clunk, and then a shaking sound he had heard someplace before. After a moment, he placed it. "Take the matches, Paul." Diamond blue tips. He didn't know what else she might have there at the foot of the bed, but one of them was a box of diamond blue tip matches. Annie turned to him and smiled again. Whatever else might have happened, her apocalyptic depression had passed. She brushed an errant lock of hair back behind her ear with a girlish gesture. It went oddly with the lock's dull, dirty half-shine. "Dull, dirty half-shine, a boy. You gotta remember that one. That one ain't half bad, a boy, I'm stone now. Oh, the past was prologue to this shit. Hey, baby, this here is the main line. Oh, fuck, I'm fucked. But this is crystal top-end shit. This is going out on a mile-high wave in a fucking rolls. This is..."
"What do you want first, Paul?" she asked. "The good news or the bad news?"
"Good news first." He managed a big, foolish grin. "Guess the bad news is that this is the end, huh? Guess you didn't like the book so great, huh? Too bad, I tried. It was even working. I was just starting to, you know, starting to drive on it." She looked at him reproachfully.
"I love the book, Paul. I told you that, and I never lie. I love it so much I don't want to read any more until the very end. I'm sorry to have to make you fill in the ends yourself, but it's like peeking."
His big foolish grin stretched even wider. He thought soon it would meet in the back, tie a lover's knot there, and most of his poor old bean would just topple off. Maybe it would land in the bedpan beside the bed. In some deep, dim part of his mind where the dope hadn't yet reached, alarm bells were going off. She loved the book, which meant she didn't mean to kill him. Whatever was going on, she didn't mean to kill him. And unless his assessment of Annie Wilkes was totally off the beam, that meant she had something even worse in store. Now the light in the room did not look dull. It looked marvelously pure, marvelously full of its own gray and eldritch charm. He could imagine cranes half-glimpsed in gunmetal mist, standing in one-legged silence beside upland lakes in that light. Could imagine the mica flecks in rocks jutting from spring grasses in upland meadows, shining with a shaggy glow of glazed window glass in that light. Could imagine elves shucking their busy selves off to work in lines under the dew-soaked leaves of early ivy in that light. "Oh boy, are you stoned," Paul thought and giggled faintly. Annie smiled in return.
"The good news," she said, "is that your car is gone. I've been very worried about your car, Paul. I knew it would take a storm like this to get rid of it, and maybe even that wouldn't do the trick. The spring runoff got rid of that Pomeroy dirty bird, but a car is ever so much heavier than a man, isn't it? Even a man as full of cock-a-doodie as he was. But the storm and the runoff combined was enough to do the trick. Your car is gone. That's the good news."
"What?" More faint alarm bells. Pomeroy. He knew that name, but couldn't think exactly how he knew it. Then it came to him. Pomeroy. The late, great Andrew Pomeroy, 23, of Coldstream Harbor, New York, found in the Grider Wildlife Preserve, wherever that was. "Now, Paul," she said in the prim voice he knew so well, "no need to be coy. I know you know who Andy Pomeroy was, because I know you've read my book. I suppose I sort of hoped you would read it, you know. Otherwise, why would I have left it out? But I made sure, you know. I make sure of everything. And sure enough, the threads were broken."
"The threads," he said faintly. "Oh, yes. I read once about a way you're supposed to find out for sure if someone has been snooping around in your drawers. You tape a very fine thread across each one. And if you come back and find one broken, why, you know, don't you? You know someone's been snooping. You see how easy it is?"
"Yes, Annie." He was listening, but what he really wanted to do was trip out on the marvelous quality of the light. Again she bent over to check whatever it was she had at the foot of the bed. Again he heard a faint, dull clunk-clank, wood thumping against some metallic object. And then she turned back, brushing absently at her hair again.
I did that with my book. Only I didn't really use threads, you know. I used hairs from my own head. I put them across the thickness of the book in three different places. And when I came in this morning, very early, creeping like a little mousie so I wouldn't wake you up, all three threads were broken. So I knew you'd been looking at my book.
She paused and smiled. It was for Annie a very winning smile. Yet it had an unpleasant quality he could not quite put his finger on.
Not that I was surprised. I knew you'd been out of the room. That's the bad news. I've known for a long, long time, Paul.
He should feel angry and dismayed, he supposed. She had known. Known almost from the start, it seemed. But he could only feel that dreamy, floating euphoria. And what she was saying did not seem nearly as important as the glorious quality of the strengthening light, as the day hovered on the edge of becoming.
But, she said with the air of one returning to business, we were talking about your car. I have studded tires, Paul, and at my place in the hills I keep a set of 10X tire chains. Early yesterday afternoon I felt ever so much better. I spent most of my time up there on my knees, deep in prayer. And the answer came, as it often does, and it was quite simple, as it often is. What you take to the Lord in prayer, Paul, he giveth back a thousandfold. So I put the chains on and I crept back down here. It was not easy, and I knew I might well have an accident in spite of the studs and the chains. I also knew that there is rarely such a thing as a minor accident on those twisty up-country roads. But I felt easy in my mind, because I felt safe in the will of the Lord. That's very uplifting, Annie, Paul croaked.
She gave him a look which was momentarily startled and narrowly suspicious. And then she relaxed and smiled.
I've got a present for you, Paul, she said softly.
And before he could ask her what it was, he wasn't sure he wanted any sort of present from Annie, she went on.
The roads were terribly icy. I almost went off twice. The second time, old Bessie slid all the way around in a circle and kept right on going downhill while she did it.
Annie laughed cheerily.
Then I got stuck in a snowbank. This was around midnight. But a sanding crew from the Eustis Public Works Department came along and helped me out.
Bully for the Eustis Public Works Department, Paul said. But what came out was a badly slurred, Bury Furter Eustis Poly Gurks Department.
The 2 miles in from the county highway, that was the last hard patch. The county highway is Route 9, you know, the road you were on when you had your wreck. They had sanded that one to a fare-thee-well. I stopped where you went off and looked for your car. I knew what I would have to do if I saw it, because there would be questions. And I'd be just about the first one they'd ask those questions to, for reasons I think you know.
I'm way ahead of you, Annie, he thought. I examined this whole scenario 3 weeks ago.
One of the reasons I brought you back was because it seemed like more of a coincidence. It seemed more like the hand of Providence.
What seemed like the hand of Providence, Annie? He managed.
Your car was wrecked in almost exactly the same spot where I got rid of that Pomeroy creep, the one who said he was an artist.
She flapped a hand in contempt, shifted her feet, and there was that wooden clunking sound, as if one of them brushed some of whatever it was she had down there on the floor.
I picked him up on my way back from Estes Park. I was there at a ceramic show. I like little ceramic figurines.
I noticed, Paul said. His voice seemed to come from light years away. Captain Kirk. There's a voice coming in over the subetheric, he thought, and chuckled dimly. That deep part of him, the part the dope couldn't reach, tried to warn him to shut his mouth, just shut it. But what was the sense? She knew. Of course she knows. The Burka Bee goddess knows everything. I particularly like the penguin on the block of ice.
Thank you, Paul. He is cute, isn't he? Pomeroy was hitchhiking. He had a pack on his back. He said he was an artist. Though I found out later, he was nothing but a hippie, dope fiend, dirty bird who'd been washing dishes in an Estes Park restaurant for the last couple of months. When I told him I had a place in Sidewinder, he said that was a real coincidence. He said he was going to Sidewinder. He said he'd gotten an assignment from a magazine in New York. He was going to go up to the old hotel and sketch the ruins. His pictures were going to be with an article they were doing. It was a famous old hotel called the Overlook. Burned down 10 years ago. Caretaker burned it down. He was crazy. Everybody in town said so. Never mind. He's dead. I let Pomeroy stay here with me. We were lovers.
She looked at him with her black eyes burning in her solid yet doughy white face. And Paul thought, if Andrew Pomeroy could get it up for you, Annie, he must have been as crazy as the caretaker that burned down the hotel.
And I found out that he didn't really have an assignment to draw pictures of the hotel at all. He was just doing them on his own, hoping to sell them. He wasn't even sure the magazine was doing an article on the Overlook. I found that out pretty quick. After I did, I sneaked a look at his sketch pad. I felt I had a perfect right to do that. After all, he was eating my food and sleeping in my bed. There were only 8 or 9 pictures in the whole book, and they were terrible.
Her face wrinkled, and for a moment she looked as she had when she had imitated the sound the pig made.
I could have made better pictures. He came in while I was looking, and he got mad. He said I was snooping. I said I didn't call looking at things in my own house snooping. I said if he was an artist, I was Madame Curie. He started to laugh. He laughed at me. So I...
You killed him, Paul said. His voice sounded dim and ancient. She smiled uneasily at the wall.
Well, I guess it was something like that. I don't remember very well. Just when he was dead. I remember that. I remember giving him a bath.
He stared at her and felt a sick, soupy horror. The image came to him. Pomeroy's naked body floating in the downstairs tub like a piece of raw dough, head reclining aslant against the porcelain, open eyes staring up at the ceiling.
I had to, Mertith. You probably don't know what the police can do with just one piece of thread, or dirt under someone's fingernails, or even dust in a corpse's hair. You don't know, but I worked in hospitals all life, and I do know. I do know. I know about forensics.
She was working herself into one of her patented Annie Wilkes frenzies, and he knew he should try and say something which would at least temporarily diffuse her, but his mouth seemed numb and useless.
They're out to get me. All of them. Do you think they would have listened if I tried to tell them how it was? Do you? Do you? Oh, no. They'd probably say something crazy like I made a pass at him, and he killed him. They'd probably say something like that.
And you know what, Annie? You know what? I think that just might be a little closer to the truth.
The dirty birdies around here would say anything to get me in trouble or smear my name.
She paused, not quite panting but breathing hard, looking at him hard, as if inviting him to just dare and tell her different.
Just you dare.
Then she seemed to get herself under some kind of control, and she went on in a calmer voice.
I washed. Well, what was left of him. And his clothes. I knew what to do. It was snowing outside. The first real snow of the year. I said we'd have a foot by the next morning. I put his clothes in a plastic bag. I wrapped the body in sheets and took everything out to that dry wash on Route 9 after dark. I walked about a mile farther down from where your car ended up. I walked until I was in the woods. Just dumped everything. You probably think I hit him, but I didn't. I knew the snow would cover him up, and I thought the spring melt would carry him away if I left him in the stream bed. And that was what happened. Except I had no idea he'd go so far. Why, they found his body a whole year after he died, almost 27 miles away. Actually, it'd been better if he hadn't gone as far as he did. because there are always hikers and bird watchers in the Grider Preserve. The woods around here are much less traveled. She smiled. That's where your car is now, Paul. Somewhere between Route 9 and the Grider Wildlife Preserve. Somewhere in the woods. It's far enough in so you can't see it from the road. I've got a spotlight on the side of old Bessie, and it's plenty powerful. But the wash is empty all the way into the woods. I guess I'll go in on foot and check when the water goes down a little. But I'm almost positive it's safe. Some hunter will find it in 2 years, or 5 years, or 7 years, all rusty, and with chipmunks nesting in the seats. And by then you'll have finished my book, and we'll be back in New York, or Los Angeles, or wherever it is you decide to go. And I'll be living my quiet life out here. Maybe we will correspond sometimes.
She smiled mistily. The smile of a woman who sees a lovely castle in the sky. And then the smile disappeared, and she was all business again.
So I came back here, and on the way I did some hard thinking. I had to, because your car being gone meant you could really stay. You could really finish my book. I wasn't always sure you'd be able to, you know. Though I never said it, because I didn't want to upset you. Partly I didn't want to upset you, because I knew you wouldn't write as well if I did. Well, that sounds ever so much colder than I really felt, my dear. You see, I began by loving only the part of you that makes such wonderful stories, because that's the only part I had. The rest of you I didn't know anything about. And I thought that part might really be quite unpleasant. I'm not a dummy, you know. I've read about some so-called famous authors, and I know that often they are quite unpleasant. Why, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and that redneck fellow from Mississippi, Faulkner, whatever it was, those fellows may have won National Pulitzer Book Awards and things, but they're nothing but cock-a-doody drunken bums just the same. Other ones, too. When they weren't writing wonderful stories, they were drinking and whoring and shooting dope and heaven knows what else. But you're not like that. And after a while, I came to know the rest of Paul Sheldon. And I hope you don't mind me saying it. But I have come to love the rest of him, too. Thank you, Annie. He said from atop his golden glistening wave, and he thought, but you may have read me wrong, you know. I mean, the situations that lead men into temptation have been severely curtailed up here. Sort of hard to go bar hopping when you've got a couple of broken legs, Annie. As for shooting dope, I've got the Borga Bee goddess to do that for me. But would you want to stay? She resumed. That was the question I had to ask myself. And as much as I may have wanted to pull the wool over my eyes, I knew the answer to that. I knew even before I saw the marks on the door over there.
She pointed, and Paul thought, I'll bet she did know, almost from the very first. Wool pulling? Not you, Annie. Never you. But I was doing enough of that for both of us.
Do you remember the first time I went away? After we had that silly fight over the paper?
Yes, Annie.
That was when you went out the first time, wasn't it?
Yes. There was no point in denying it.
Of course. You wanted your pills. I should have known you'd do anything to get your pills. But when I get mad, I get... you know.
She giggled, a little nervously. Paul did not join her, or even smile. The memory of that pain-racked, endless interlude with a phantom voice of the sportscaster doing the play-by-play was still too strong. Yes, I know how you get, he thought. You get oogie.
First, I wasn't completely sure. Oh, I saw that some of the figures on the little table in the parlor had been moved around. But I thought I might have done that myself. I have times when I'm really quite forgetful. It crossed my mind that you'd been out of your room, but then I thought... No, that's impossible. He's so badly hurt, and besides, I locked the door. I even checked to make sure the key was still in my skirt pocket, and it was. And then I remembered you were in your chair. So maybe... One of the things you learn when you've been an RN for 10 years is that it's always wise to check your maybes. So I took a look at the things I keep in the downstairs bathroom. They're mostly samples I brought home on and off while I was working. You should see all the stuff that just goes rolling around in the hospital, Paul. So every now and then I help myself to a few. Well, a few extras, and I wasn't the only one. But I knew enough not to take any of the morphine-based drug. They lock those up. They count. They keep records. And if they get an idea that a nurse is, you know, chipping, that's what they call it. They watch that nurse until they're sure. Then, bang! Annie chopped her hand down hard. Out they go. Most of them never put on the white cap again. I was smarter than that. Looking at those cartons was the same as looking at the figures on the little parlor table. I thought the stuff on them had been sort of stirred around. And I was pretty sure that one of the cartons that was on the bottom before was on the top of some of the other cartons now, but I couldn't be sure. And I could have done it myself when I was, well, when I was preoccupied. And 2 days later, after I had just about decided to let it go, I came in to give you your afternoon medication. You were still having your nap. I tried to turn the doorknob. For a few seconds, it wouldn't turn. It was like the door was locked. Then it did turn, and I heard something rattle inside the lock. Then you started to stir around, so I just gave you your pills like always. Like I didn't suspect. I'm very good at that, Paul. Then I helped you into your chair so you could write. When I helped you into it that afternoon, I felt like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. My eyes were opened. I saw how much of your color had come back. I saw that you were moving your legs. They were giving you pain, and you could only move them a little. But you were moving them. And your arms were getting stronger again as well. I saw you were almost healthy again. That was when I started to realize I could have a problem with you, even if no one from the outside suspected a thing. I looked at you and saw I might not be the only one good at keeping secrets. That night I changed your medication for something a little stronger. And when I was sure you weren't going to wake up, even if someone exploded a grenade under your bed, I got my little toolkit from the cellar shelf, and I took the keyplate off that door. And look what I found. She took something small and dark from one of the flap pockets of her mannish skirt. She put it in his numb hand. He brought it up close to his face and stared at it owlishly. It was a bent and twisted chunk of bobby pin. Paul began to giggle. He couldn't help it. What's so funny, Paul? The day you went to pay your taxes. I needed to open the door again. The wheelchair was almost too big. It left black marks. I wanted to wipe them off if I could.
So I wouldn't see them.
Yes. But you already had, hadn't you?
After I found one of my bobby pins in the lock, she smiled herself. You bet your Rudy Patooties I had.
Paul nodded and laughed even harder. He was laughing so hard tears were squirting from his eyes. All his work, all his worry, all for nothing. It seemed deliciously funny. He said, I was worried that piece of bobby pin might mess me up. But it didn't. I never even heard it rattling around. And there was a good reason for that, wasn't there? It never rattled because he took it out. What a fooler you are, Annie.
Yes, she said, and smiled thinly. What a fooler I am.
She moved her feet. That muffled wooden thump from the foot of the bed came again.
How many times were you out in all?
The knife. Oh, Christ, the knife. Twice. No, wait. I went out again yesterday afternoon around 5 o'clock to fill up my water pitcher. That was true. He had filled the pitcher, but he had omitted the real reason for his third trip. The real reason was under his mattress. The Princess and the Pea. Polly and the Pig sticker. 3 times counting the trip for the water.
Tell the truth, Paul.
Just 3 times, I swear. And never to get away. For Christ's sake, I'm writing a book here in case you didn't notice.
Don't use the Savior's name in vain, Paul.
You quit using mine that way, and maybe I will.
The first time I was in so much pain that it felt like someone had put me into hell from the knees on down. And someone did. You did, Annie.
Shut up, Paul!
The second time, I just wanted to get something to eat. Make sure I had some extra supplies in here in case you were gone a long time, he went on, ignoring her. Then I got thirsty. That's all there is, no big conspiracy.
You didn't try the telephone either time, I suppose. Or look at the locks. Because you were just such a good little boy.
Sure, I tried the phone. Sure, I looked at the locks. Not that I would have gotten very far in the mud bath out there, even if your doors had been wide open. The dope was coming in heavier and heavier waves. And now he just wished she would shut up and go away. She had already doped him enough to tell the truth. He was afraid he would have to pay the consequences in time. But first he wanted to sleep.
How many times did you go out?
I told you.
How many times?
Her voice was rising.
Tell the truth!
I am. 3 times.
How many times, goddammit?
In spite of the cruiser load of dope she'd shot into him, Paul began to be frightened. At least if she does something to me, it can't hurt too much. And she wants me to finish the book. She said so. He noticed how shiny her skin was, like some sort of polymer plastic stretched tightly over stone. There seemed to be no pores at all in that face. Annie, I swear.
Oh, liars can swear. Liars love to swear. Well, go ahead and treat me like a fool if that's what you want. That's fine. Goody-goody for you. Treat a woman who isn't a fool as if she were, and that woman always comes out ahead. Let me tell you, Paul, I've stretched threads and strands of hair from my own head all over this house. And I found many of them snapped later on. Snapped or entirely gone. Just disappeared. Poof! Not just on my scrapbook, but in this hallway, across my dresser drawers upstairs, in the shed, all over!
Annie, how could I possibly get out in the shed with all those locks on the kitchen door? He wanted to ask, but she gave him no time, only plunged on.
Now you go right ahead, and keep telling me it was only 3 times! Mr. Smart Guy, and I'll tell you who the fool is.
He stared at her, groggy but appalled. He didn't know how to answer her. It was so paranoid, so crazy. My God, he thought, suddenly forgetting the shed. Upstairs. Did she say upstairs? Annie, how in God's name could I get upstairs?
Oh, right! She cried,
her voice cracking.
Oh, sure! I came in here a few days ago, and you'd managed to get into your wheelchair all by yourself. If you could do that, you could get upstairs. You could crawl!
Yes, on my broken legs and my shattered knee, he said. Again that black look of crevasse, the batty darkness under the meadow. Annie Wilkes was gone. The Borka Bee goddess was here.
You don't want to be smart to me, Paul, she whispered.
Well, Annie, one of us has to at least try, and you're not doing a very good job. If you just try to see how...
How many times?
3.
The first time to get... And the second time to get food.
That's right.
The third time it was to fill up the pitcher.
Yes, Annie, I'm so dizzy.
You filled it up in the bathroom up the hall.
Yes.
Once for medication, once for food, and once for water. Yes, I told you.
He tried to yell, but what came out was a strengthless croak. She reached into her skirt pocket again and brought out the butcher knife. Its keen blade glimmered in the brightening morning light. She suddenly twisted to the left and threw the knife. She threw it with the deadly, half-casual grace of a carnival performer. It stuck, quivering, in the plaster below the picture of the Arc de Triomphe.
I investigated under your mattress a little before I gave you your pre-op shot. I expected to find capsules. The knife was a complete surprise. I almost cut myself. But you didn't put it there, did you?
He didn't reply. His mind was spinning and diving like an out-of-control amusement park ride. Pre-op shot.
Was that what she had said? Pre-op. He was suddenly utterly sure that she meant to pull the knife from the wall and castrate him with it.
No, you didn't put it there. You went out once for medication, once for food, and once for water. This knife must have... Why, it must have floated in here and slid under there all by itself. Yes, that's what must have happened.
Annie shrieked derisive laughter. Pre-op. Dear God, is that what she said?
Damn you, she cried. God damn you! How many times?
All right, all right. I got the knife when I went out for the water. I confess. If you think that means I was out any number of times, go on and fill in the blank. If you wanted to be 5 times, it was 5. If you wanted to be 20 or 50 or 100, that's what it was. I'll admit it, however many times you think, Annie, that's how many times I was out.
For a moment, in his anger and dopey befuddlement, he had lost sight of the hazy, frightening concept inherent in that phrase, pre-op shot. He wanted to tell her so much. Wanted to tell her even though he knew that a raving paranoid like Annie would reject what was so obvious. It had been damp. Scotch tape did not like the damp. In many cases, her Ludlamesque little traps had undoubtedly just peeled off and floated away on some random draft. And the rats. With a lot of water in the cellar and the mistress of the manor gone, he had heard them in the walls. Of course, they had the run of the house, and they would be attracted by all the oogie stuff Annie had left around. The rats were probably the gremlins who had broken most of Annie's threads, but she would only push such ideas away. In her mind, he was almost ready to run the New York Marathon.
Annie. Annie, what did you mean when you said you gave me a pre-op shot?
But Annie was still fixated on the other matter.
I say it was 7, she said softly. At least 7. Was it 7? If you want it to be 7, it was 7.
What did you mean when you said, I can see you mean to be stubborn, she said.
I guess fellows like you must get so used to lying for a living that you just can't stop doing it in real life. That's all right, Paul, because the principle doesn't change. If you were out 7 times or 70, or 70 times 7, the principle doesn't change, and neither does the response.
He was floating, floating, floating away. Closed his eyes and heard her speak as if from a long distance away. Like a supernatural voice from a cloud. Goddess, he thought.
You ever read about the early days at the Kimberley Diamond Mines, Paul?
I wrote the book on that one, he said, for no reason at all, and laughed. Pre-op? Pre-op shot?
Sometimes the native workers stole diamonds. They wrapped them in leaves and poked them up their rectums. They got away from the big hole without being discovered, they would run. You know what the British did to them if they got caught before they could get over the Orange Riviere and into Boer country?
Kill them, I suppose, he said, eyes still closed.
Oh, no. That would have been like junking an expensive car just because of a broken spring. If they caught them, they made sure they could go on working. But they also made sure they would never run again. The operation was called Hobbling Paw. And that is what I'm going to do to you. For my own safety. And yours as well. Believe me, you need to be protected from yourself. Just remember, a little pain and it will be over. Try to hold that thought.
Terror, sharp as a gust of wind filled with razor blades, blew through the dope. And Paul's eyes flew open. She had risen and now drew the bedclothes down, exposing his twisted legs and bare feet. No, he said. No. Annie... Whatever it is you got on your mind, we can talk about it, can't we? Please. She bent over. When she straightened up, she was holding the axe from the shed in one hand and a propane torch in the other. The blade of the axe gleamed. Written on the side of the propane torch was the word Burns-O-Matic. She bent down again and this time came up with a dark bottle and a box of matches. There was a label on the dark bottle. Written on the label was the word Betadine. He never forgot these things. these words, these names.
Annie, no! He screamed. Annie, I'll stay right here! I won't even get out of bed! Please! Oh, God, please don't cut me!
It'll be all right, she said. And her face now had that slack, unplugged look. That look of perplexed vacuity. And before his mind was completely consumed in a forest fire of panic, he understood that when this was over, she would have only the vaguest memories of what she had done, as she had only the vaguest memories of killing the children and the old people and the terminal patients and Andrew Pomeroy. After all, this was the woman who, although she'd gotten her cap in 1966, had told him only minutes ago that she had been a nurse for 10 years. She killed Pomeroy with that same axe. I know she did. He continued to shriek and plead, but his words had become inarticulate babble. He tried to turn over, turn away from her, and his legs cried out. He tried to draw them up, make them less vulnerable, less of a target, and his knees screamed.
Only a minute more, Paul, she said,
and uncapped the betadine. She poured a brownish-red muck over his left ankle.
Only a minute more, and it's over.
She tipped the blade of the axe flat, the tendon standing out in her strong right wrist, and he could see the wink of the amethyst ring she still wore on the pinky finger of that hand. She poured betadine on the blade. He could smell it, a doctor's office smell. That smell meant you were going to get a shot.
Just a little pain, Paul. It won't be bad.
She turned the axe over and splashed the other side of the blade. He could see random flowers of rust blooming on this side before the goop covered it.
Annie, Annie, oh, Annie, please, please, no, please don't, Annie. I swear to you, I'll be good. I swear to God, I'll be good. Please give me a chance to be good. Oh, Annie, please, let me please be good.
Just a little pain, then this nasty business will be behind us for good, Paul.
She tossed the open bottle of betadine over her shoulder, her face blank and empty, and yet so inarguably solid. She slid her right hand down the handle of the axe almost to the steel head. She gripped the handle farther up in her left hand and spread her legs like a logger.
Annie, oh, please, please don't hurt me.
Her eyes were mild and drifting.
Don't worry, she said. I'm a trained nurse.
The axe came whistling down and buried itself in Paul Sheldon's left leg just above the ankle. Pain exploded up his body in a gigantic bolt. Dark red blood splattered across her face like Indian war paint. It splattered the wall. He heard the blade squeal against bone as she wrenched it free. He looked unbelievingly down at himself. The sheet was turning red. He saw his toes wriggling. Then he saw her raising the dripping axe again. Her hair had fallen free of its pins and hung around her blank face. He tried to pull back in spite of the pain in his leg and knee, and realized that his leg was moving, but his foot wasn't. All he was doing was widening the axe slash, making it open like a mouth. He had time enough to realize his foot was now only held on his leg by the meat of his calf, before the blade came down again, directly into the gash, shearing through the rest of his leg, and burying itself deep in the mattress. Springs boinked and squinked. Annie pulled the axe free and tossed it aside. She looked absently at the jetting stump for a moment, and then picked up the box of matches. She lit one. Then she picked up the propane torch with the word Burns-O-Matic on the side, and twisted the valve on the side. The torch hissed. Blood poured from the place where he no longer was. Annie held the match delicately under the nozzle of the Burns-O-Matic. There was a floof sound. A long yellow flame appeared. Annie adjusted it to a hard blue line of fire. Can't suture, she said. No time. Tourniquet's no good. No central pressure point. Got to rinse. Cauterize. She bent. Paul screamed as fire splashed over the raw and bleeding stump. Smoke drifted up. It smelled sweet. He and his first wife had honeymooned on Maui. There had been a luau. This smell reminded him of the smell of the pig when they brought it out of the pit where it had cooked all day. The pig had been on a stick, sagging, black, falling apart. The pain was screaming. He was screaming.
"Almost over," she said,
and turned the valve. And now the ground sheet caught fire around the stump that was no longer bleeding. The stump that was as black as the pig's hide had been when they brought it out of the luau pit. Eileen had turned away, but Paul had watched, fascinated, as they pulled off the pig's crackling skin, as easily as you might skim off a sweater after a football game.
"Almost over."
She turned the torch off. His leg lay in a line of flames with his severed foot wavering beyond it. She bent and now came up with his old friend, the yellow floor bucket. She dumped it over the flames. He was screaming, screaming. The pain, the goddess, the pain, oh, Africa. She stood looking at him, at the darkening bloody sheet, with vague consternation. Her face was the face of a woman who hears on a radio that an earthquake has killed 10,000 people in Pakistan or Turkey.
"You'll be all right, Paul," she said.
But her voice was suddenly frightened. Her eyes began to dart aimlessly around, as they had when it seemed that the fire of his burning book might get out of control. They suddenly fixed on something, almost with relief.
"I'll just get rid of the trash."
She picked up his foot. Its toes were still spasming. She carried it across the room. By the time she got to the door, they had stopped moving. He could see a scar on the instep and remembered how he had gotten that, how he had stepped on a piece of bottle when he was just a kid. Had that been at Revere Beach? Yes, he thought it had been. He remembered he had cried, and his father had told him it was just a little cut. His father had told him to stop acting like someone had cut his goddamn foot off. Annie paused at the door and looked back at Paul, who shrieked and writhed in the charred and blood-soaked bed, his face a deathly fading white.
"Now you're hobbled," she said. "And don't you blame me. It's your own fault."
She went out. So did Paul. The cloud was back. Paul dived for it, not caring if the cloud meant death instead of unconsciousness this time. He almost hoped it did. Just no pain, please. No memories, no pain, no horror, no Annie Wilkes. He dived for the cloud, dived into the cloud, dimly hearing the sounds of his own shrieks and smelling his own cooked meat. As his thoughts faded, he thought, "Goddess, kill you. Goddess, kill you. Goddess." Then there was nothing but nothing. Three, Paul. It's no good. I've been trying to sleep for the last half hour, and I can't. Writing here is a sort of drug. It's the only thing I look forward to. This afternoon I read what I wrote, and it seemed vivid. I know it seems vivid because my imagination fills in all the bits another person wouldn't understand. I mean, it's vanity. But it seems a sort of magic, and I just can't live in this present. I would go mad if I did. John Fowles, The Collector. Chapter 32. "Oh, blessed Jesus," Ian moaned, and made a convulsive movement forward. Geoffrey grasped his friend's arm. The steady beat of the drum pulsed in his head like something heard in a killing delirium. Bees droned around them, but one paused. They simply flew past and into the clearing as if drawn by a magnet, which Geoffrey, ho sickly, hey. Paul picked up the typewriter and shook it. After a time, a small piece of steel fell out onto the board across the arms of the wheelchair. He picked it up and looked at it. It was the letter T. The typewriter had just thrown its T. He thought, I'm going to complain to the management. I'm going to not just ask for a new typewriter, but fucking demand one. She's got the money, I know she does. Maybe it's squirreled away in fruit jars under the barn, or maybe it's stuffed in the walls at her laughing place. But she's got the dough. And T, my God, the second most common letter in the English language. Of course, he would ask Annie for nothing, much less demand. Once there had been a man who would at least have asked. A man who had been in a great deal more pain. A man who had had nothing to hold on to. Not even this shitty book. That man would have asked. Hurt or not, that man had had the guts to at least try to stand up to Annie Wilkes. He had been that man, and he supposed he ought to be ashamed. But that man had had two big advantages over this one. That man had had 2 feet and 2 thumbs. Paul sat reflectively for a moment, reread the last line, mentally filling in the omissions, and then simply went back to work. Better that way. Better not to ask. Better not to provoke. Outside his window, bees buzzed. It was the first day of summer. Had been.
Let me go,
Ian snarled, and turned on Jeffrey, his right hand curling into a fist. His eyes bulged madly from his livid face, and he seemed totally unaware of who was holding him back from his darling. Jeffrey realized with cold certainty that what they had seen when Hezekiah pulled the protective screen of bushes aside had come very close to driving Ian mad. He still tottered on the brink, and the slightest push would send him over. If that happened, he would take misery with him.
Ian, let me go, I say!
Ian pulled backward with furious strength, and Hezekiah moaned fearfully.
No, boss. Make them bees crazy. Them sting, mistress.
Ian seemed not to hear. His eyes wild and blank, he lashed out at Jeffrey, striking his old friend high on the cheekbone. Black stars rocketed through Jeffrey's head. In spite of them, he saw Hezekiah beginning to swing the potentially deadly gosha, a sand-filled bag the Borkas favored for close work, in time to hiss,
No! Let me handle this!
Reluctantly, Hezekiah allowed the gosha to subside to the end of its leather string like a slowing pendulum. Then Jeffrey's head was rocked back by a fresh blow. This one mashed his lips back against his teeth, and he felt the warm, salt-sweet taste of blood begin to seep into his mouth. There was a rough purring sound, as Ian's dress shirt, now sun-faded and already torn in a dozen places, began to come apart in Jeffrey's grasp. In another moment, he would be free. Jeffrey realized with dazed wonder that it was the same shirt Ian had worn to the Baron and Baroness's dinner party 3 nights ago. Of course it was. There had been no opportunity to change since then. Not for Ian, not for any of them. Only 3 nights ago. But the shirt looked as if Ian had been wearing it for at least 3 years. And Jeffrey felt as if at least 300 had passed since the party. Only 3 nights ago, he thought again with stupid wonder. And then Ian was raining blows into his face.
Let me go, damn you!
Ian drove his bloody fist into Jeffrey's face again and again. His friend for whom, in his right mind, he would have died.
Do you want to demonstrate your love for her by killing her?
Jeffrey asked quietly. If you want to do that, then by all means, old boy, knock me senseless. Ian's fist hesitated. Something at least approximating sense came back into his terrified, maddened gaze. I must go to her, he murmured like a man in a dream. I'm sorry I hit you, Jeffrey. Truly sorry, my dear old man. And I'm sure you know it. But I must... You see her. He looked again as if to confirm the dreadfulness of the sight, and again made as if to rush to where Misery had been tied to a post in a jungle clearing, her arms over her head. Glimmering on her wrists and fastening her to the lowest branch of the eucalyptus, which was the only tree in the clearing, was something the Burkas had apparently taken a fancy to before sending Baron Heitzig into the mouth of the idol and to his undoubtedly terrible death, the Baron's blued steel handcuffs. This time it was Hezekiah who grabbed Ian, but the bushes rustled again and Geoffrey looked into the clearing, his breath momentarily catching in his throat, as a bit of fabric may catch on a thorn. He felt like a man who must walk up a rocky hill with a load of decayed and dangerously volatile explosives in his arms. One sting, he thought. Just one, and it's all over for her. No, boss, mustn't, Hezekiah was saying with a kind of terrified patience. It like the other boss be saying, if you go out there, the bees wake up from the daydream. And if the bees wake, it don't matter for her, she be dying of one sting or dying of 1 to 1,000 stings. If the bees wake up from the daydream, we all die. But she die first, and the most horrible. Little by little, Ian relaxed between the two men, one of them black, the other white. His head turned toward the clearing with dreadful reluctance, as if he did not wish to look, and yet could not forbear to. Then what are we to do? What are we to do for my poor darling? I don't know, came to Geoffrey's lips, and in his own state of terrible distress, he was barely able to bite them back. Not for the first time, it occurred to him that Ian's possession of the woman Geoffrey loved just as dearly, if secretly, allowed Ian to indulge in an odd sort of selfishness and an almost womanly hysteria that Geoffrey himself must forego. After all, to the rest of the world he was only misery's friend. Yes, just her friend, he thought, with half-hysterical irony. And then his own eyes were drawn back to the clearing, to his friend. Misery wore not a stitch of clothing, yet Geoffrey thought that even the most prudish church thrice-a-week village Biddy could not have faulted her for indecency. The hypothetical old prude might have run screaming from the sight of Misery, but her screams would have been caused by terror and revulsion rather than outraged propriety. Misery wore not a stitch of clothing, but she was far from naked. She was dressed in bees. From the tips of her toes to the crown of her chestnut hair, she was dressed in bees. She seemed almost to be wearing some strange nun's habit. Strange because it moved and undulated across the swells of her breasts and hips, even though there was not even a ghost of a breeze. Likewise, her face seemed encased in a wimple of almost Mohammedan modesty. Only her blue eyes peered out of the mask of bees, which crawled sluggishly over her face, hiding mouth and nose and chin and brows. More bees. Giant Africa browns, the most poisonous and bad-tempered bees in all the world, crawled back and forth over the barren steel bracelets before joining the living gloves on Misery's hands. As Geoffrey watched, more and more bees flew into the clearing from all points of the compass. Yet it was clear to him, even in his current distraction, that most of them were coming from the west, where the great dark stone face of the goddess loomed. The drums pulsed their steady rhythm, in its way as much as soporific as the sleepy drone of the bees. But Geoffrey knew how deceptive that sleepiness was. He had seen what happened to the Baroness, and only thanked God that Ian had been spared that, and the sound of that sleepy hum suddenly rising to a furious buzzsaw squeal, a sound which it had first muffled and then drowned the woman's agonized dying screams. She had been a vain and foolish creature, dangerous as well. She had almost gotten them killed when she had freed Stringfellow's bushmaster. But silly or not, foolish or not, dangerous or not, no man or woman deserved to die like that. In his mind, Geoffrey echoed Ian's question. What are we to do? What are we to do for our poor darling? Hezekiah said, Nothing can do now, boss. But she in no danger. As long as the drums they beat, the bees will sleep. And mistress, she is going to sleep too. Now the bees covered her in a thick and moving blanket. Her eyes, open but unseeing, seemed to be receding into a living cave of crawling, stumbling, droning bees. And if the drums stop, Jeffrey asked in a low, almost strengthless voice. And just then, the drums did. For a mom, Paul looked unbelievingly at the last line, then picked the royal up. He had gone on lifting it like some weird barbell when she was out of the room, God knew why, and shook it again. The keys clittered, and then another chunk of metal fell out on the board which served as his desk. Outside, he could hear the roaring sound of Annie's bright blue riding lawnmower. She was around front, giving the grass a good trim so those cock-a-doody roidmans wouldn't have anything to talk about in town. He set the typewriter down, then rocked it up so he could fish out this new surprise. He looked at it in the strong late-afternoon sunlight slanting in through the window. His expression of disbelief never altered. Printed in raised and slightly ink-stained metal on the head of the key was E-E. Just to add to the fun, the old royal had now thrown the most frequently used letter in the English language. Paul looked at the calendar. The picture was of a flowered meadow and the month said May, but Paul kept his own dates now on a piece of scrap paper, and according to his homemade calendar, it was June 21st. "Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer," he thought sourly, and threw the key hammer in the general direction of the wastebasket. "Well, what do I do now?" he thought. But of course he knew what came next. Longhand. That was what came next. But not now. Although he had been tearing along like a house of fire a few seconds ago, anxious to get Ian, Jeffrey, and the ever-amusing Hezekiah caught in the Borkus ambush so that the entire party could be transported to the caves behind the face of the idol for the rousing finale, he was suddenly tired. The hole in the paper had closed with an adamant bang. Tomorrow. He would go to Longhand tomorrow. Fuck Longhand. Complain to the management, Paul. But he would do no such thing. Annie had gotten too weird. He listened to the monotonous snarl of the riding lawnmower, saw her shadow, and as so often happened when he thought of how weird Annie was getting, his mind recalled the image of the axe rising, then falling, the image of her horrid, impassive, deadly face splattered with his blood. Broken. Every word he screamed. The squeal of the axe pulling away from the severed bone, the blood on the wall. All crystal clear. And as he also so often did, he tried to block this memory and found himself a second too late. Because the crucial plot twist of Fast Cars concerned Tony Bonassaro's near-fatal crack-up, in his last desperate effort to escape the police, and this led to the epilogue, which consisted of the bruising interrogation conducted by the late Lieutenant Gray's partner in Tony's hospital room. Paul had interviewed a number of crash victims. He had heard the same thing time and time again. It came in different wrappers, but it always boiled down to the same thing. "I remember getting into the car. And I remember waking up here. Everything else is a blank." Why couldn't that have happened to him? Because writers remember everything, Paul. Especially the hurts. Strip a writer to the buff, point to the scars, and he'll tell you the story of each small one. From the big ones, you get novels, not amnesia. A little talent is a nice thing to have if you want to be a writer. But the only real requirement is that ability to remember the story of every scar. Art consists of the persistence of memory. Who had said that? Thomas Sass? William Faulkner? Cindy Lauper? But that last name brought its own association, a painful and unhappy one under these circumstances. A memory of Cindy Lauper hiccuping her way cheerfully through Girls Just Want to Have Fun that was so clear it was almost auditory. "Oh, Daddy dear, you're still number one. But girls, they want to have fun on. Oh, when the working day is done, girls just want to have fun." Suddenly he wanted a hit of rock and roll worse than he had ever wanted a cigarette. It didn't have to be Cyndi Lauper. Anyone would do. Jesus Christ, Ted Nugent would be just fine. The axe coming down. the whisper of the axe. Don't think about it. But that was stupid. He kept telling himself not to think about it, knowing all the while that it was there, like a bone in his throat. Was he going to let it stay there? Or was he going to be a man and sick the fucking thing up? Another memory came then. It seemed like this was an all-request oldies day for Paul Sheldon. This one was of Oliver Reed as the mad but silkily persuasive scientist in David Cronenberg's movie The Brood. Reed urging his patients at the Institute of Psychoplasmatics, a name Paul had found deliciously funny, to go through it. Go all the way through it. Well, maybe sometimes that wasn't such bad advice. I went through it once. That was enough. Bullshit was what that was. If going through things once was enough, he would have been a fucking vacuum cleaner salesman like his father. Go through it, then. Go all the way through it, Paul. Start with misery. No. Yes. Fuck you. Paul leaned back, put his hand over his eyes, and like it or not, he began to go through it. All the way through it. He hadn't died, hadn't slept, but for a while after Annie hobbled him, the pain went away. He only drifted, feeling untethered from his body, a balloon of pure thought rising away from its string. Oh, shit, why was he bothering? She had done it, and all the time between then and now had been pain and boredom and occasional bouts of work on his stupidly melodramatic book to escape the former two. The whole thing was meaningless. Oh, but it's not. There is a theme here, Paul. It's the thread that runs through everything. The thread that runs so true. Can't you see it? Misery, of course. That was the thread that ran through everything. But true thread or false, it was so goddamn silly. As a common noun, it meant pain, usually lengthy and often pointless. As a proper one, it meant a character in a plot, the latter most assuredly lengthy and pointless, but one which would nonetheless end very soon. Misery ran through the last 4, maybe it was 5, months of his life, all right. Plenty of misery. Misery day in and misery day out. But surely that was too simple. Surely, oh no, Paul. Nothing is simple about misery. Except that you owe her your life, such as that may be. Because you turned out to be Scheherazade after all, didn't you? Again he tried to turn aside from these thoughts, but found himself unable. The persistence of memory and all that. Hacks just want to have fun. Then an unexpected idea came, a new one which opened a whole new avenue of thought. What you keep overlooking, because it's so obvious, is that you were, are, also Scheherazade to yourself. He blinked, lowering his hand and staring stupidly out into the summer he had never expected he would see. Annie's shadow passed and then disappeared again. Was that true? Scheherazade to myself? He thought again. If so, then he was faced with an idiocy that was utterly colossal. He owed his survival to the fact that he wanted to finish the piece of shit Annie had coerced him into writing. He should have died, but couldn't. Not until he knew how it all came out. Oh, you're fucking crazy. You sure? No. He was no longer sure. Not about anything. With one exception. His whole life had hinged and continued to hinge on misery. He let his mind drift. The cloud, he thought. Begin with a cloud. This time the cloud had been darker, denser, somehow smoother. There was a sensation not of floating, but of sliding. Sometimes thoughts came, and sometimes there was pain. And sometimes, dimly, he heard Annie's voice, sounding the way it had when the burning manuscript in the barbecue had threatened to get out of control. Drink this, Paul. You've got to. Sliding. No. That was not quite the right verb. The right verb was sinking. He remembered a telephone call which had come at 3 in the morning. This was when he was in college. Sleepy fourth-floor dorm proctor hammering on his door, telling him to come on and answer the fucking phone. His mother. Come home as quick as you can, Polly. Your father has had a bad stroke. He's sinking. And he had come as fast as he could, pushing his old Ford wagon to 70 in spite of the front-end shimmy that developed at speeds over 50. But in the end, it had all been for nothing. When he got there, his father was no longer sinking, but sunk. How close had he himself come to sinking on the night of the axe? He didn't know, but the fact that he had felt almost no pain during the week following the amputation was a pretty clear indication of just how close, perhaps. That and the panic in her voice. He had lain in a semi-coma, barely breathing because of the respiratory depressant side effects of the medication, the glucose drip back in his arms again. And what brought him out of it was the beat of drums and the drone of bees. Burka drums. Burka bees. Burka dreams. Color bleeding slowly and relentlessly into a land and a tribe that were never beyond the margins of the paper on which he wrote. A dream of the goddess. The face of the goddess looming black over the jungle green, brooding and eroded. Dark goddess. Dark continent. A stone head full of bees. Overlying even all this was a picture, which grew clearer and clearer, as if a giant slide had been projected against the cloud in which he lay, as time passed. It was a picture of a clearing in which one old eucalyptus tree stood. Hanging from the lowest branch of this tree was an old-fashioned pair of blued steel handcuffs. Bees were crawling over them. The cuffs were empty. They were empty because Misery had escaped. She had, hadn't she? Wasn't that how the story was supposed to go? It had been, but now he wasn't so sure. Was that what those empty handcuffs meant? Or had she been taken away? Taken into the idol? Taken to the queen bee? The big babe of the Burkas? You were also Scheherazade to yourself. Who are you telling the story for, Paul? Who are you telling it to? To Annie? Of course not. He did not look through that hole in the paper to see Annie, or please Annie. He looked through it to get away from Annie. The pain had started, and the itch. The cloud began to lighten again and rift apart. He began to glimpse the room, which was bad, and Annie, which was even worse. Still, he had decided to live. Some part of him that was as addicted to the chapter plays as Annie had been as a child had decided he could not die until he saw how it all came out. Had she escaped, with the help of Ian and Jeffrey? Or had she been taken into the head of the goddess? It was ridiculous, but these stupid questions actually seemed to need answering. She didn't want to let him go back to work. Not at first. He could see in her skittery eyes how frightened she had been and still was, how close he had come. She was taking extravagant care of him, changing the bandages on his weeping stump every day who knows she will never get a medal for what she has done, although she deserves one. She had done it every 4 hours, giving him sponge baths and alcohol rubs, as if to deny what she had done. Work, she said, would hurt him. It would put you back, Paul. I wouldn't say it if it weren't so, believe me. At least you know what's ahead. I'm dying to find out what happens next. It turned out she had read everything he had written. All his pre-surgery work, you might say, while he lingered near death. Better than 300 manuscript pages. He hadn't filled in the ends in the last 40 or so. Annie had done that. She showed him these with an uneasily defiant sort of pride. Her ends were textbook neat, a striking comparison with his own, which had degenerated into a humpbacked scrawl. Although Annie had never said so, he believed she had filled in the ends either as another evidence of her solicitude. How can you say I was cruel to you, Paul, when you see all the ends I have filled in? Or as an act of atonement, or possibly even a quasi-superstitious rite. Enough bandage changes, enough sponge baths, Enough ends filled in, and Paul would live. Borka be woman work powerful, moja magic buona. Fill in all these hoodaddy ends, and all will be well again. That was how she had begun. But then the gada set in. Paul knew all the symptoms. When she said she was dying to find out what happened next, she wasn't kidding. Because you went on living to find out what happened next. Isn't that what you're really saying? Crazy as it was, shameful even in its absurdity, he thought it was. The gada. It was something he had been irritated to find he could generate in the misery books almost at will, but in his mainstream fiction erratically or not at all. You didn't know exactly where to find the gada, but you always knew when you did. It made the needle of some internal Geiger counter swing all the way over to the end of the dial. Even sitting in front of the typewriter slightly hungover, drinking cups of black coffee and crunching a Rolaid or two every couple of hours, knowing he should give up the fucking cigarettes, at least in the morning, but unable to bring himself to the sticking point. Months from finishing and light years from publication, you knew the gada when you got it. Having it always made him feel slightly ashamed, manipulative, but it also made him feel vindicated in his labor. Christ, days went by, and the hole in the paper was small, the light was dim, the overheard conversations witless. You pushed on because that was all you could do. Confucius say, if man want to grow one row of corn, must first shovel one ton of shit. And then one day the hole widened to vista vision width, and the light shone through like a sun ray in a Cecil B. DeMille epic, and you knew you had the gada, alive and kicking. The gada, as in, I think I'll stay up another 15-20 minutes, honey. I gotta see how this chapter comes out. Even though the guy who says it spent the day at work thinking about getting laid, and knows the odds are good his wife is going to be asleep when he finally gets up to the bedroom. The gada, as in, I know I should be starting supper now. He'll be mad if it's TV dinners again, but I gotta see how this ends. I gotta know, will she live? I gotta know, will he catch the shitheel who killed his father? I gotta know if she finds out her best friend's screwing her husband. The gada. Nasty as a hand job in a sleazy bar. Fine as a fuck from the world's most talented call girl. Oh boy, it was bad. And oh boy, it was good. And oh boy, in the end, it didn't matter how rude it was or how crude it was. Because in the end, it was just like the Jackson said on that record. Don't stop till you get enough. You were also Scheherazade to yourself. That was not an idea he was able to articulate or even understand. Not then. He had been in too much pain. But he had known just the same, hadn't he? Not you. The guys in the sweatshop. They knew. Yes. That had the ring of the right. The sound of the riding mower swelled louder. Annie came into view for a moment. She looked at him, saw him looking back, and raised a hand to him. He raised one of his own, the one with the thumb still on it, in return. She passed from sight again. Good deal. He was finally able to convince her that returning to work would put him forward, not back. He was haunted by the specificity of those images which had lured him out of the cloud, and haunted was exactly the right word. Until they were written down, they were shades which would remain unlaid. And while she hadn't believed him, not then, she had allowed him to go back to work just the same. Not because he had convinced her, but because of the gada. At first he had been able to work only in painfully short bursts, 15 minutes, maybe half an hour if the story really demanded it of him. Even short bursts were agony. A shift in position caused the stump to come brightly alive, the way a smoldering brand will burst into flame when fanned by a breeze. It hurt furiously while he wrote, but that was not the worst. The worst was the hour or two afterward, when the healing stump would madden him with a drony itch, like swarming sleepy bees. He had been right, not her. He never became really well, probably could not do so in such a situation. But his health did improve, and some of his strength came back. He was aware that the horizons of his interest had shrunk. but he accepted this as the price of survival. It was a genuine wonder he had survived it all. Sitting here in front of this typewriter, with its increasingly bad teeth, looking back over a period which had consisted of work rather than events, Paul nodded. Yes, he supposed he had been his own Scheherazade, just as he was his own dream woman when he grabbed hold of himself and jacked off to the feverish beat of his fantasies. He didn't need a psychiatrist to point out that writing had its own autoerotic side. You beat a typewriter instead of your meat. But both acts depended largely on quick wits, fast hands, and a heartfelt commitment to the art of the far-fetched. But hadn't there also been some sort of fuck, even of the driest variety? Because once he started again, well, she wouldn't interrupt him while he was working, but she would take each day's output as soon as he was done, ostensibly to fill in the missing letters. But actually, he knew this by now, just as sexually acute men know which dates will put out at the end of the evening and which ones will not, to get her fix, to get her gotta. The chapter plays, yes, back to that. Only for the last few months she's been going every day instead of just on Saturday afternoons. And the Paul who takes her is her pet writer instead of her older brother. His stints at the typewriter grew gradually longer as the pain slowly receded, and some of his endurance returned. But ultimately he wasn't able to write fast enough to satisfy her demands. The gotta which had kept them both alive, and it had, for without it she surely would have murdered both him and herself long since, was also what had caused the loss of his thumb. It was horrible, but also sort of funny. Have a little irony, Paul. It's good for your blood. And think how much worse it could have been. It could have been his penis, for instance. And I only have one of those, he said, and began to laugh wildly in the empty room, in front of the hateful royal with its gap-toothed grin. He laughed until his gut and stump both ached, laughed until his mind ached. At some point the laughter turned to horrible dry sobs that awoke pain even in what remained of his left thumb. And when that happened, he was finally able to stop. He wondered in a dull sort of way how close he was to going insane. Not that it really mattered, he supposed. One day, not long before the thumbectomy, perhaps even less than a week, Annie had come in with two giant dishes of vanilla ice cream, a can of Hershey's chocolate syrup, a pressure can of Ready Whip, and a jar in which maraschino cherries, red as heart's blood, floated like biology specimens.
I thought I'd make a Sunday's, Paul, Annie said.
Her tone was spuriously jolly. Paul didn't like it. Not her tone of voice, nor the uneasy look in her eyes. I'm being a naughty girl, that look said. It made him wary, put his wind up. It was too easy for him to imagine her looking exactly the same way when she put a heap of clothes on one set of stairs, a dead cat on the other. Why, thank you, Annie, he said, and watched as she poured the syrup and puffed two cumulus clouds of whipped cream out of the pressure can. She performed these chores with the practiced heavy hand of the longtime sugar junkie.
No need for thanks. You deserve it. You've been working so hard.
She gave him his sundae. The sweetness became cloying after the third bite, but he kept on. It was wiser. One of the key rules to survival here on the scenic western slope was to wit, when Annie's treatin', you best be eatin'. There was silence for a while, and then Annie put her spoon down, wiped a mixture of chocolate syrup and melting ice cream off her chin with the back of her hand, and said pleasantly,
tell me the rest.
Paul put his own spoon down. I beg your pardon?
Tell me the rest of the story. I can't wait. I just can't.
And hadn't he known this was coming? Yes. If someone had delivered all 20 reels of the new Rocket Man chapter play to Annie's house, would she have waited, parceling out only one a week, or even one a day? He looked at the half-demolished avalanche of her sundae, one cherry almost buried in whipped cream, another floating in chocolate syrup. He remembered the way the living room had looked, with sugar-glazed dishes everywhere. No, Annie was not the waiting type. Annie would have watched all 20 episodes in one night, even if they gave her eye strain and a splitting headache. Because Annie loved sweet things. "I can't do that," he said. Her face had darkened all at once, but hadn't there been a shadowy relief there as well?
"Oh, why not?"
"Because you wouldn't respect me in the morning," he thought of saying, and clamped down on that. Clamped down hard. "Because I'm a rotten storyteller," he answered instead. She slurped up the remainder of her sundae in 5 huge spoonfuls that would have left Paul's throat gray with frostbite. Then she set her dish down and looked at him angrily, not as if he were the great Paul Sheldon, but as if he were someone who had presumed to criticize the great Paul Sheldon.